Welcome to AUSA's Army Matters podcast. This is Thought Leaders with Joe Craig. My guest today is Susan Eisenhower, author of How Ike Led, The Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decisions. Susan Eisenhower is one of Ike's four grandchildren, a consultant, an author, and a Washington, D.C.-based policy strategist with many decades of work on national security issues. She lectures widely on such topics, including strategic leadership. Ms. Eisenhower, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
First, I just want to say congratulations on the new book. It's been getting great praise from some very prominent people. And one of the main themes of the book is that of Ike as a strategic leader rather than an operational one. How would you define the difference?
Well, I think a strategic leader has to factor in all kinds of things that are unique to that position. For instance, he has to be thinking about resources, timelines, the politics associated with any operation, and he has to connect the dots across a whole range of factors. And then, of course, a strategic plan is put together, and other people, commanders in the Army sense, would take different pieces of it. But he's the person who pulls it all together.
Now, in personal recollections of times with your grandfather, you note that Ike always made a strong distinction between, you know, work time and personal time. But even with that in mind, I suspect, did he have an influence on your ultimate choice of career?
Well, you know, it's funny. We probably should have all gone into the medical field or something. That's the only place he really didn't have a large and long shadow. National security was discussed a lot at the dining room table when I was a kid. I was about almost 18 years old when he died, so I had lots of time with Granddad in his retirement, and inevitably, subjects like that came up. My brother and I were the noisy ones. We were always debating these issues with him, and I think it had a lot to do with it. May I also say very quickly that the visit of Nikita Khrushchev to the United States in 1959 and then his arrival at the Eisenhower farm while they were negotiating the conditions around the Berlin ultimatum, the Berlin crisis at that time, was very influential for me. I never got over meeting Nikita Khrushchev, and so I spent a big part of my career in Soviet and then later Russian affairs.
Right. And certainly I want to talk a little bit more of that in detail a little later. Just to start off with the book, obviously, you know, Dwight Eisenhower had phenomenal success as a military commander and later as president. But he always knew that he had to also plan for failure. So you start the book with the unused communique from the Normandy invasion. Would you tell the listeners what that was and how it exemplified his leadership?
Well, I think after all these years, we finally know about this unused communique. For many years, it had been buried in Harry Butcher's diaries. But it's an extraordinary story about a note that Ike wrote for himself should the invasion of Normandy fail. And the note basically says that he takes full responsibility for the operation, and he praises the troops and the Navy, the Army, the airborne troops for doing all they could do. And if there is a failure, the failure is his alone. I think also that chapter is important because it underscores the very heavy decision he had to make just before D-Day related to whether or not he would be using airborne forces against the advice of his technical expert on that subject.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that moment with British Air Marshal coming in just days before the planned invasion saying he wanted to call it off, that was quite remarkable.
Well, you know, I think the most remarkable part of the story is that knowing that his technical expert predicted between 50% and 70% losses, Eisenhower has to make the strategic decision, again, this is something only he could do, as to whether or not to use those forces or not. And after making that decision, factoring in a very dicey weather forecast that even the weather forecasters themselves didn't agree on, he went that night just before the paratroopers took off for the Normandy coast and looked them in the eye and wished them well and reminded them of home.
Right.
And I think that showed a kind of maturity as a leader to be able to accept the fact that people were going to be impacted by the decisions he made.
Yeah, I mean, that personal side definitely comes through throughout the tales. And I was struck by something from early in his career where he vowed he was going to make each of his commanding officers regret his departure for the next assignment. And, you know, one of those early commanders was General Douglas MacArthur. It's hard to imagine two different leadership styles between those two. How did they get along?
Well, you know, I'm laughing because, yes, it would be hard to imagine two different leadership styles. As a matter of fact, I think probably one of Ike's other vows was that he was going to be the young MacArthur. And that is not surprising in a way, because MacArthur was a very flamboyant individual. Ike was raised in a deeply religious Kansas farm community, and he eschewed all of the attention getting and other things that MacArthur seemed to thrive on. It's also, in terms of a relationship, it's kind of funny later that after the war, MacArthur desperately wanted to be president of the United States, and Dwight Eisenhower spent 6 years trying to figure out how to get out of the possibility of becoming president, though he later decided that the situation in the United States was such that it was vital to retain a two-party system in our country. The Democrats had already been in power for 20 years, and also the Republicans were offering only isolationism and massive tax cuts in the face of huge budget deficits. So Ike decided that he would sign up to take this on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you talk about Ike at that point in his career. You know, he had left the Army after succeeding George Marshall as chief of staff, and he had pretty much settled into, you know, a new phase of his personal life, writing his memoirs, taking the position as president of Columbia University, and then taking a leave of absence to serve as the first commander of NATO. So it is remarkable that for someone who tried to avoid politics at all points, did have to ultimately decide it was best for the nation to run for president.
One of my favorite parts of that story is that Sherman Adams, who was the governor of New Hampshire, wanted to put Eisenhower on the New Hampshire ballot, but didn't know whether he was a Democrat or Republican.
Right.
So they wrote to the county clerk in Abilene, Kansas, and the bottom line is that the county clerk in Abilene, Kansas, just shrugged his shoulders and says, "I don't think he has any politics." So, you know, it's an interesting story from my perspective, because I think it's fair to say that not since George Washington have we had such an apolitical president. He was nonpartisan to the extent that anybody who runs on a ticket can be, and had not only Democrats in his administration, but he actually even appointed a Democrat to the Supreme Court.
During an election year, not less, right?
During an election year, exactly. It's just that because he came from the military, he saw the importance of leading for the entire country. And he did not have a political base in any sense of the word that we know now. And that actually worked to his advantage. His political base was actually the people who'd served under him during the war and the enormous war effort that had been put together. He was associated with a successful outcome. And he tried to bring everybody along with a sense of common purpose. He called it the middle way.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, that background coming from the military, and kind of goes to the heart of what you said was his most commonly asked question during cabinet meetings, you know, what is best for America? So I think some might have suspected when he became president, there would have been some favoritism toward the Army, but those who knew him knew that was not going to be the case. And in fact, he was very tough on, you know, their budgets, on inter-service rivalries. Can you talk a little bit more about the relationship between the president and the military at that time?
I have to say, this is one of the most interesting parts of the story for me. If you really think about it, he was very, very hard on the people who were closest to him. And what had emerged after the war was a complete change in the thinking about how wars would be fought in the future. World War II was probably the last big conventional war. It is the last conventional war we will ever have of this kind. And with the advent of nuclear weapons, in Eisenhower's view, everything had changed. The problem was many in all branches of the services wanted things the way they were before. And there was a lot of rivalry. There was a lot of effort to go around the president and go directly up to Capitol Hill. As a matter of fact, the military had so many lobbyists up on Capitol Hill at various times that it did nothing to make Dwight Eisenhower feel more comfortable in their presence. And I think it's fascinating, after the Soviet launch of Sputnik in 1957, that Ike uses that as an opportunity for a defense reform bill that actually finally gave the Secretary of Defense the authority he needed to manage this inter-service rivalry. I don't think that made him any friends, by the way, among the military. But Eisenhower's new job was to represent all of the American people and to do what was right for the country, not for his old colleagues. And I think it's a fairly complicated but rather stunning story, really.
Yeah, he was a man of his word, and he did do what was best. And in fact, Andrew Goodpaster, you know, you said that he noted that one of Eisenhower's greatest assets was his honesty. And, you know, his allies could trust him, and even adversaries knew that he was a credible person. So how did that play into relations with the Soviets and with Khrushchev?
I think, first of all, what you're talking about is sort of trust and credibility. And that's something that has to be earned every day. Part of his duty, as he saw it, was to figure out how to bring America into the nuclear age. And to your question, the Soviet Union went through a phenomenally complicated transition after the death of Joseph Stalin in 1953. And a man named Nikita Khrushchev emerged over the course of the years. And he was a very, talk about flamboyant. Now, there was a flamboyant man who was highly emotional, and he seemed impulsive, sometimes irrational, and frankly hard to deal with. And this was a critical relationship because by this time we had enough nuclear weapons to really change the face of warfare, especially with the advent of the hydrogen bomb, which was detonated just before Dwight Eisenhower became president.
Right. And as you know, Eisenhower was going through the process of managing that relationship, he had to quell domestic fears. And you referenced earlier, you know, the launch of Sputnik. And I think many would be surprised that, you know, when that happened in October of 57, it wasn't actually the surprise that many people think of it today as. You know, there had been announcements in the papers and the weeks and months ahead of that. Now, using the outcry that came afterwards, how did Ike leveraged that crisis for, you know, strategic long-term American goals?
Well, first of all, Sputnik happens, of course, in the middle of another crisis that ended up being critical during that time, the Little Rock civil rights crisis. That was Ike's determination to see the desegregation of Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, happens in September. And in the beginning of October, the Soviet Union launched the first artificial satellite. Not only was it not a surprise to the Eisenhower administration that the Soviet Union was going to do that, we actually had an agreement with them for both countries to launch artificial satellites in 1957 under the umbrella of the International Geophysical Year, which was the product of, you know, the scientific community's desire to explore new spaces. Right. So Ike was caught off guard. At first, people were just surprised. Obviously, they weren't reading the front page of the New York Times, which announced this thing was going to be launched in a couple of days. But I think politics took over in a big way, because what was a sort of a managed response in the beginning, by the end of October, had become really quite the political issue. I think this may have had something to do with drumming up support in the 1958 midterm elections. But the country was also going through a cyclical recession, and people were just caught off guard and began to panic. Well, Eisenhower uses this opportunity to do a number of things. I mentioned the Defense Reform Act earlier. He also instituted a big push on the part of the federal government to fund schools to enhance our capabilities in the STEM area. We talk about that a lot today. He instituted NASA. He originated NASA and did a very important thing, which was to make it a civilian agency and not part of the military, to underscore that what NASA was doing was for peaceful purposes only in outer space. And then he started what was then known as ARPA, which is today known as DARPA, which was to bring about leading edge innovation in the technology arena. And he used Sputnik as leverage to get those things done, even though he knew Sputnik was coming. Right. Having said that, I think he was still surprised that Americans were so fearful. And this sense of fear plays out into the next big controversy that comes up about the missile gap, accusing the Eisenhower administration of allowing the Soviet Union to gain superiority in the building of missiles, which turned out not to be true at all. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the way I think about it, Joe, is that the intersection of politics and national security can be very, very loaded, especially when it comes into election time. I think he found that disconcerting and disappointing because he didn't think much of people who politicized, after all, very, very serious issues. And he was deeply aware that our adversaries were reading American newspapers, too. So the president got put into a bind because he could not give away classified information publicly and try and quell all of the accusations against the administration with respect to defense preparedness. And he was ready to take that responsibility, too, simply because the public had gotten wound up going into a 1960 presidential campaign. If I could just say one other thing here, too, is that I was raised to compartmentalize my personal relationship with Granddad. That's what I call him when I'm thinking from my own experience. But to make that distinction between that and his career, and I must say that I was really very moved on a number of occasions to read the research on how much he had managed politically. It required a lot of courage and tenacity, I think. And having said that, I spent a lot of time with him in those years, and I compare what he was going through when we were doing certain things as a family, and I just found it stunning as I wrote this book to realize how extraordinarily self-disciplined he was, because we just didn't get evidence of this at home. And I say at home because we lived very close to him, both in the last years of his presidency and also when he retired to Gettysburg.
Yeah, and the number of his accomplishments throughout, you know, not only his military career, but his two terms in office are just far too many to really go into detail here. You close out the book with the scene of the funeral train, you know, taking the general and his $81 GI casket on his way to Abilene to be buried next to the son that he lost when the boy was only three. What would you like the next generation to know about Ike's legacy?
Well, I ended with that scene of the funeral train. And actually, as I mentioned in the book, my father and I were the last people to see his remains. And I just wanted the readers to know that he died as he lived, as a man of modesty and humility. And that's what I want rising generations to know. I want them to know a little bit more about the history. But I also want them to know that there was a kind of principled leadership that existed at points in our history, and that they should expect more. They should expect more from the leaders we have today, and that they should expect and frankly insist upon finding leaders who are willing to put our country before their own personal interests.
Yep. Again, going back to that theme of what's best for America. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much for being our guest today, Ms. Eisenhower. I just want to remind listeners again that her new book is How Ike Led, The Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decisions.
To all our listeners, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. The Army Matters podcast series is brought to you by the Association of the United States Army, the U.S. Army's professional association, member-supported, Army-connected. Visit us at AUSA.org for more information or to become a member. Your membership helps AUSA continue to carry out its mission to educate, inform, and connect with the total Army, our industry partners, and our supporters of a strong national defense. For questions or to provide topic recommendations, email us at podcast@AUSA.org. Have a great Army Day. Hooah.